Hey guys, real quick before we jump into this next episode, I want to discuss something with you. I made a decision a couple of years ago not to bombard this podcast with tons of ads or just bombard you with sponsorship. Nothing would drive me more crazy when listening to other podcasts when the first 5 minutes were nothing but ads. So I worked hard not to do that to you. I try to keep the ads to a minimum and keep the podcast as streamlined as possible. So do me a favor. Go check out Phoenix Shooting Bags. Buy yourself a bag. Up your shooting game. You're going to thank me. And if you're not a rifle hunter, go buy yourself a glassing pad. Your butt is going to thank me after spending hours behind the glass. They're awesome. If you use promo code John Stallone, all one word, you'll save 20%. And lastly, please, I know you heard me say it, iTunes, Podbean, go leave us a review. I need the feedback. The ratings help me reach more people, and it helps me keep this free. So do me a favor, check out Phoenix Shooting Bags, and go leave us a review. Thank you. Let's roll into this next episode. Hi, welcome to Interviews with the Hunting Masters, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. Today, we are going to talk a little bit about shot angles, tuning your bow, things you should be doing during the season, to improve your chances of success. I have Nathan Brooks with us, and Nathan is a very accomplished archer. He's been an IBO world champion two times, ASA Classic champion, indoor national champion. Been named Shooter of the Year. And when Nathan is not shooting at foam and targets, he's hunting elk, deer, and turkey. And so I feel like his experiences on and off the course gives him a unique perspective on, you know, form and tuning and shot execution that he'll be able to answer the questions that we have. What's going on, man?
Much, buddy. Got out of the tree stand a little earlier and try to make it in here. Make sure I was on time for this date we have.
Nice. Whereabouts were you hunting?
I'm in Arkansas.
Okay.
Yeah. So just chasing the whitetails around this morning. Not much luck. Actually, saw one little 5-point for you guys out west. That's a 2x3. Yeah, just a little year and a half old buck this morning. Got that full moon going on, so probably would do better if I went right now and set till about 3 o'clock. So,
yeah, absolutely. You know, I was just in New York hunting whitetail, and it wasn't quite a full moon yet, but I had, you know, basically 3/4 moon, and I was seeing bucks right from that 11 a.m. to about like 1:30. Come cruising through. They were checking the scrape lines. Yep. And I just couldn't catch up with my target buck. I had two bucks that I was after. A buck we call Bullwinkle. It's got a real lopsided rack, just a nice 8-pointer, clean, you know, no stickers, whatever. And then there's another buck that we call Blades. He's got these giant bladed brow tines and just a stud buck. He's only four. They're both only 4.5, but you know, 4.5 years old bucks. So if I didn't get them this year, and if they don't get killed, they'll be going to be even bigger next. But yeah, I just couldn't catch up with them. They just seemed to be zigging when I was zagging. So
yeah, they have a knack for that. It seems like those big old bucks, man. I tell you, you know what's funny? I have a friend of mine just. Actually two buddies killed some really nice bucks this past weekend. We got a cool front that moved through. It's amazing to me how I have some friends that are just buck magnets and then there's me that I fight and claw and scratch for every one that I can see, it seems like. And then those guys, they can just walk out in the middle of a cow pasture where there's nothing and they just come to them. So
yeah, you gotta love that. You can't beat luck. What's that saying? I'd rather be lucky than good.
Yeah, no doubt. Absolutely.
Yeah. No, that's for sure. Actually, this is my first year as an adult hunting in New York that I did not shoot a buck. First year, I had some I had opportunities to shoot what I call medium bucks.
Yeah.
Oh, that 115 range, nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, nothing exciting. Couple of bucks are, I mean, just stud 2.5 year old bucks, six pointers, and you know, good rack on them, and they're just gonna, they're gonna be something good in a few. I was gonna take my recurve, and if I had my recurve, I totally would have shot it.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that brings a whole new level to everything. I hunt with the recurve too, especially here at home a lot because we have so many deer, and it's a blast to actually get after them with the recurve. Just for the simple fact that, if things ain't working out with the compound, I'm not seeing the bigger bucks, then hey, I just get out there and get after some deer and put some meat in the freezer with the recurve, and man, it's fun. It just it really puts a lot of fun back into the hunting.
Right. Last year I went with the recurve, and dude, I felt like I started hunting all over again. Like, you know, it was like something completely. And I hunt hogs and javelina with traditional equipment, but I never hunt deer with it because I'm just, I don't know. I always feel like I need the technology, you need the compound, and even though we've been killing things with stick and string for, millennium, but it's just, I don't know. But so I finally bit, last year I said, I'm going to take that, and I was like, oh, it's just fun, because every deer is exciting.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, when one comes in, you start getting excited, because like, hey, it's starting to happen. It's going to happen right now. And with the recurve, too, what I find is that it brings to light things that you might have been overlooking even with your compound. With the recurve, let's face it, they got to be close. You want them up close, you want them up, personal, that sort of thing, just right in your space. And with the compound, sometimes I'm looking at things a little differently, and not that I don't want them up close, even with my compound, but maybe I might try and figure out how to get another 10 yards closer. And sometimes that's a challenge. I mean, that extra 10 yards is huge, and it really makes you think about every little thing that you're doing with your stand setups, watching the deer and their movement and everything. It takes it all to a whole new level. I really do. I absolutely love hunting with the stick.
Yeah, it's something. It's different. I don't know that I would do spot and stalk hunts with it yet, but stand hunting I could do, because I feel like I can control the narrative a little bit, with the stand.
Exactly. Yeah. So,
yeah. But anyway, what was I going to ask you? Oh, so, because you said Arkansas, I just wanted to ask you something. When you said originally, you guys don't start rutting in Arkansas until like January, right, or end of December?
It depends on where you're at. I live in northwest Arkansas. I am 13 miles from the Oklahoma border. That's to my west, and I actually grew up in Oklahoma. I only live an hour from where I grew up, so. But I'm 13 miles from the Oklahoma border, and I'm about an hour drive south of the Missouri border. So I'm in northwest Arkansas, and we rut just normal time here, like second week of November. It's full on. So come the end of usually from about Halloween on, you start seeing a lot of activity. So
gotcha. Okay. Yeah, because I was gonna come out there in the late season one time. I got a buddy of mine that runs a radio show out of Arkansas, and he has invited me several times, and I was going to come in late December or something like that, and he said that's when the rut was on, and I was like, oh, okay, yeah, cool, because I've haunted Alabama, I've haunted Florida, Georgia, and it always seems to be that later, like here, it's December, January also, so.
That southeast section of Arkansas is a January, late December rut. And as you progress, further up in the state, you see a lot. I mean, it just starts changing.
It's crazy. Texas does that too. Yeah. But Texas is bigger. I mean,
I could see it more in there. But yeah, Texas is funny because the northern part above Dallas and all that stuff, it's November. And then, you know, down south, it's December, January.
And we see a decent amount of second rut action as well. And I don't know if it's just because they don't actually all get bred that first rut, or if it's just because some of them are just coming in late. So we do see a good mixture of first rut, second rut sort of thing. So it's not over if you missed it. If you missed it in November, just hang around for December. You'll see some action.
Nice. All right, cool. Yeah, because I'm planning on coming. I have this goal that I'm going to shoot a whitetail or at least a deer in every state. So Arkansas is on my bucket list. As with quitting plenty, I've only hit 15 so far. So I got a lot to go. But anyway, so let me jump into these questions. A lot of these questions came from our Ask the Pro section and just from questions I got on social media. So I like this question. I've actually asked it one time before a couple years ago. Hunting season is here right now, you know, in the midst of hunting season. Everybody is shooting a bunch leading up to hunting season. But then once hunting season starts, I feel like I know myself, I'm not going out and shooting quite as often as I was. What are some of the things you could do throughout the season to prepare to making that one shot? You know, basically, what can somebody do to ensure he creates, not creates the best opportunity, but he or she can, what do you call it? My God, my brain is not working today. This is what happens when when I'm away and I'm burning the midnight oil on both ends, that, you know, they could take advantage of an opportunity that comes their way, basically.
Well, you know, throughout the season, obviously, as people are practicing and things like that, I think I know there's a lot of target shooters that that prepare for the adrenaline rush. And that's the thing that you have a difficult time recreating. All right. So when you're deer hunting or any type of hunting, and you know it's about time to pull the string back, you know, the heart rate usually goes through the roof.
Right.
And so that's obviously what that air quoting here, the nervousness that people talk about. But you can look at that a couple of different ways. It's nerves. But it's also excitement. Mm-hmm. So excitement brings on something that brings a positive feed, whereas nerves, you look at it as a negative feed. Right. So if you understand that it's excitement and that it's just your body doing what it should do, that adrenaline rush is being spiked, the heart rate's pumping, that sort of thing, you can actually prepare pretty well for that, actually. You can work out, get that heart rate up, do some cardio, jump on a treadmill, run as fast as you can on a treadmill for a while, jump off and shoot an arrow. I mean, as soon as you jump off with the heart rate just doop, 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 you know, it's hitting really hard. And you can shoot those arrows then and see how well you do. And if you really want to test that, I'm a big fan of the cold shot. And that, all right, I've got everything sighted in. I've worked hard. You know, everything's supposed to be just rocking and rolling. Driving tacks, you know. If I've heard it one time, I've heard it 1,000. I'm shooting skull can groups at 40 yards, you know, that sort of thing. But get that heart rate thumping like that on a treadmill, then take that bow, run out there at 40 yards and see what kind of shot you make and see if you keep it in that skull can. If you keep it in the skull can, you really are shooting skull can groups. If you don't do that, well, then maybe we need to reconsider how we're talking about how we're shooting, because that moment of truth is defined by how you handle that heart rate. And you can like I said, you can look at that two different ways. You can be expecting that adrenaline rush, and when you're expecting it, you automatically handle it better, because when you're looking for that, you're not dreading it, okay? So if you're looking for it in a positive way and you know that it's excitement, I can't wait for that. You know, that's the way it is. That's the way I try and approach shoot off situation, things like that, where I'm, you know, competing, and, you know, now it's actually down to the end. And hey, guess what? These next few shots, even though all the shots up to that point have been part of the effort to earn the big paycheck. But guess what? These last few, they actually make the difference. You know, these are the ones where it boils down to, all right, if I hit this one, I win this sucker. You know, there's 20 grand in my pocket. If I miss, well, it's a lot less. Let's just put it that way. So, you know, that heart rate gets up. And when you're expecting it, when you're excited about it, when it's something that you look forward to, and just understand that everyone else is dealing with the same thing, you don't put yourself out there on that island, and where it's so much harder just to exist. So, like I said, I think the best way to do it is to, number one, focus everything to be a positive, and remember that it's going to happen. You're here for that moment when that big buck walks in. Well, holy smokes, what have you been hunting for this whole time? Right, you know, right. What's the reasoning? Have I been sitting here just to pass my time? No, this is the guy I've been looking for, this one right here. And when he comes in, you know, am I excited about that? Absolutely. Can I handle that? Well, only if you've prepared the right way. Right. And well, you know, you can't handle it just by spur of the moment sort of thing too. But let's face it, most deer are probably killed that way. But I really think the chances go way up when you start mentally preparing for things rather than just physically getting my bow ready, physically getting my form good, all that sort of thing. You've got to wrap your head around the mental part of hunting, shooting, all of it together. So,
yeah. No, for sure. I completely agree with you. I've been preaching that for years. Matter of fact, I have on YouTube, I have videos from like 9 years ago of me running sprints and then shooting and doing stuff like that to mimic getting your heart rate up. The cold shot, I tell people all the time, oh, you know, they're pinned out to 80 yards. They're pinned out to 90 yards. Or, you know, about out west, people got sliders to 150, whatever. And I'm like, okay, walk out to 150 right now. No warm-up shot, no shot at 30 yards, no shot at 50 yards, whatever. Walk out to 150. If you could put it in, you know, in a baseball-sized hole at that distance, then that's, you know, good. And I like it. Hearing it from you because, you know, you're an accomplished archer, and it just – I think it solidifies what I've been saying for a long time. You said something else that kind of I don't know if you've ever experienced this or not, like sitting in the tree stand, have you imagined the deer coming in and your imagination's been so vivid that your heart rate starts going, that you get excited like it was actually happening?
I've psyched myself up so many times in the stand, it's ridiculous doing that. And that's part of that mental preparation that you're talking about. When I won my first indoor national championship, 2 weeks prior to that, I put my bow down completely. I didn't even shoot. I didn't practice all the way up to it. I mean, literally, the day I arrived in Louisville, Kentucky, which is, you know, a 11-hour drive from here, was the first time I'd pulled my bow out to even shoot it in 2 weeks. And all I had been doing was every night in my living room, I would or the kitchen, I'd turn the lights off after everybody went to bed, and I would shoot a full round in my head. And I would go through that, through each visualization, you know, from loading the arrow, how it feels, feeling the in-depth feel, you know, what the knock feels like between my index finger and my thumb when I load the arrow on the string, trying to make it as real as possible. And really elevate my senses to the point of, you know, your subconscious mind doesn't know whether this is actually happening or not. It just knows to imprint how you handle it. And so as I do these things every night, I'm just trying to see myself making perfect shots, perfect follow through, all the way down to the final shoot-off, and I was, you know, imagining myself against actually Chance Bobeff at the time, because he was winning everything, and I thought, well, if you're going to beat, if you're going to be the best, you got to beat the best. So that's who I was imagining, and actually, it came down to me and him and Braden Guillentine, and Chance actually got third. So when it was just me and Braden, in my mind, I just thought, well, I don't know who this guy is, because I've already won this thing like so many times, it's ridiculous, you know. So I had absolutely zero nerves whatsoever at all. So to answer that question, have I sat in the stand and visualized that? So many times I've done that, you know, because you see the game camera picture picks of this certain buck, and you think, all right, here he is, here he is, here's the way he looked coming in, you know, to my left, and here he is coming in from my right, or here he is right underneath me, or whatever, you know. So absolutely, and the heart rate just gets going, and you just get psyched, and yeah, it's exactly the way you, I think it's exactly the way you need to do. If you're not doing that, I think you're probably missing out on an opportunity for success when it actually presents itself.
I agree. I tell people all the time, like, if you can't see yourself doing it, it's going to be a lot harder to do. And the other thing is, I think it's just kind of a neat way to kind of get past your time in the stand. It's kind of hard to sit up there for a long time, you know. But, oh, anyway. Let me get to this next question, because I think I can sit there and talk about that for a long time. Name three things that you see people do out on the range, like three common errors that hurt their shooting.
Well, I'm going to give these to you in reverse order. I've ranked them, if so. I got this question list a little bit ago. I was like, oh, yeah, I know this perfectly. So my number three is the setup is done incorrectly. And granted, a lot of people don't know what they're doing with their equipment. They have a dealer, and the dealer sets it up, and too often the dealer doesn't know what he's doing very well. And so, and then sometimes you got the individual that's setting things up and they're trying to learn, and, or maybe they have been doing it for a long time and they still just ain't quite got everything figured out. And then there's also the incorrect setup that's by design, because I've talked to numerous people on the range, and I'll be looking at something. For instance, D-loop is a very interesting part of the bow. It's very intricate, you know. I mean, the way the knock snaps on the serving and how tight that knock fits on the string at full draw with that D-loop pressing down on it, it's a big deal, and it creates tuning it's a tuning nightmare at times. It creates havoc on the knock, and I see so many people do that incorrectly, and they go out and they shoot, and maybe they shoot pretty good, but every once in a while they get these flyers and they think, well, you know, what's going on? And there's no doubt that if you can do everything absolutely 100% exactly every time, it doesn't matter how you do it, it will go in the same spot. Right. I test on shooting machines all the time, and they don't fail. They do it correctly. But the problem is, you've got the human element, and when you start changing your the way you're shooting the shot, or how you're standing, or this or that, it creates just a little bit of tension here or there that maybe wasn't there before. And then so that affects something, and then again. So, I mean, the D-loop was just something that I gravitated to because I see it set up so incorrect so much. And that would be number three on the list of the three you're talking about. Number two, trying to make themselves into this cookie cutter form. I bet if I've seen one picture, I've seen 10,000 on Archery Talk, how's my form? And then you get every answer that is just straight out of how to, if there is such a book, how to create the best form for archery idiots. you know, because that's usually what it is. It's an unbelievable stretch of the imagination that we're all made the same way, that we should all be able to draw the bow back and we should all look a certain way when we shoot. And what was funny, my most recent activity on Archery Talk was I saw one of those posts about how's my form. I look at it, and this guy had commented on there and told him that his collarbones were too high and that he had drawn lines all over this picture to try and, you know, quote, help this guy get better. And I don't doubt that that he had the best of intentions. I really do think he was trying to help. But, I mean, the guy looked pretty good. I mean, as far as his form goes, I know professional shooters that look way worse as far as that cookie cutter form, but they can just shoot phenomenally well. And so I commented on there something to the effect of, you know, I think you guys really overthink this. If you can just repeat it and it's comfortable to you over and over and over, that's really all that matters, because, you know, these bows that are being made these days are adaptable to the shooters. So you don't have to really adapt to the bow. You just need the bow to be able to adapt to you. So when I made those comments, I mean, this guy starts, you know, chewing me up and spitting me out on the other side about, oh, well, you know, all this sort of stuff about, well, he was just, you know, it just went on and on and on about how, you know, I didn't know what I was talking about, and if I ever actually helped anybody shoot, you know, if I was a coach, then I would know, and blah, blah, blah. I mean, and what was funny was my handle there on Archery Talk, I didn't actually do it on purpose. It was something I did on my phone, and it just created a handle for me. Mm-hmm. And so my credentials obviously weren't listed there, and I really like that, because I'd much rather fly under the radar and just see how someone responds to you. And so I posted a picture of Matt Stutzman, the armless archer. I don't know how familiar you are with Matt, but Matt is one of the best shooters in the world, and he does it with no arms.
Right.
And so I posted the picture, and I said, so what advice would you give him with his collarbones? Exactly. What does he need to do? You know, so, I mean, it's just ludicrous, some of the stuff that people come up with. So that cookie cutter form is great, and there's a few people that make that look really nice. For instance, Jesse Broadwater. I mean, he is textbook, if I've ever seen textbook. But there's very few people that fit that mold. And so the number one thing is find what works for you. And you can't do that by just trying one way. You have to try multiple ways. Figure out what fits you best. And keep good enough results. Keep good enough notes.
Right.
That you can make that decision on your own. That way you don't have to have somebody telling you need to do it this way or you need to do it that way. Make that decision on your own. That way you own it. And, you know, when you take that ownership of your own personal well-being, your own personal form, all that sort of stuff, then you have no excuses. And it makes you feel way more confident in what you're doing. So, and then the number one thing is no plan of how to execute a shot. And this is so broad. I mean, I could jump into this and never touch bottom.
Right.
But I'll just try and touch on the basics of it. And people just start shooting, and all they're told is put the pin on and shoot the shot. Okay, so that's all well and good if that's your intentions. For instance, I don't have a problem with someone punching a trigger or triggering the shot, shooting on command. Absolutely nothing wrong with that, but you better know that's how you're doing it, and you're doing it like that purposely.
Yep.
If you're not doing it that way on purpose, you're constantly going to battle the mental struggle of aiming. And don't get me wrong, you're going to battle the mental struggle of aiming, whether you squeeze a release, whether you shoot a hinge-style release, or whether you shoot on command. You're constantly going to battle aiming. That's just the nature of the beast. But when you have a plan of execution and saying, this is how I'm going to do it, and this is what's best for me. Again, it goes back to figuring out what works best for you as the individual. But you put a plan in motion, and you see that through. And then if it works, wonderful. If it doesn't, then go back to the drawing board. Find something else that works. Try something else for a long enough time that you have a good enough data that you can say, this is the right way for me. I mean, I'm getting, and there's really no way to quantify that unless you're keeping good data that's repeatable. Right. For instance, indoor shooting, 20 yards. You can shoot round after round after round at 20 yards indoor with zero wind. Really about the only thing you ever have to deal with is a lighting change. So that can really show you what you're doing. You know, because if you go out here and you shoot a 3D course one day and you shoot this great score, and the next day you go out and you shoot a bad score, well, you What's can't really
reason. Yeah, it could be any.
Right. Yeah, it could be wind. It could be lighting. It could be the distances changed. It could be, you know, a number of things. But when you have a, you know, just something set in stone about how you're doing it, you have a constant that you're doing over and over. In any experiment, you got to have a constant. So that's basically what it is. It's a shooting experiment. I mean, that's what we do. We continually experiment with things to see what's going to make us better. And that plan of execution is the number one thing I see people doing wrong, because I can ask them, you know, how are you doing this? Well, then they explain to me how they're doing it. Is that how you want to do it? Well, I don't know. I mean, should this be the right way? I mean, they've never thought it through. And about 19 times out of 20, they never finish with, oh, yeah, and then I follow through. You know, it's like that's totally lost. And Dean Pridgen, he was he's still around. He still hunts, does all kinds of stuff. Dean's in his 80s now, and he was an NFAA professional shooter for a long time, won all kinds of stuff. And he's close to home here, and he used to tell me, the first thing that you lose when you're shooting bad is your follow through, and it's the last thing you get when you're shooting good. So if you're looking for that follow through, if you're looking to create that follow through, 9 times out of 10, you'll figure it out really quick, because you're working towards a goal. You have something set in front of you. Okay, so I'm looking for this follow through to feel a certain way. So, yes, I'm aiming. Yes, I'm executing my shot. But as soon as that shot fires, if you want that follow-through to feel a certain way, you'll make that happen. And I'm not saying you force it, but at the same time, you never get that follow-through if you're not looking for it.
It's a conscious effort.
Yes, absolutely. You have to work towards it. And I've found that to be 100% true in my career worth of shooting. Is when I'm shooting really well, I can tell you how every arrow feels at the very end of the shot.
Right.
Just because that follow through is there, and I know how it, you know, I know how my muscles reacted and if it was the right reaction or not, you know. So that's my three right there. Set up incorrect and trying to make himself into a cookie cutter forms and no plan of execution.
You are like my archery philosophy twin. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been on the course and guys have come up to me and try to correct my form and stuff like that. And they, you know, you never want to get, just like, you know, you were talking about archery talk, you never want to get in a, you know, do you want to see my resume match with people? But when I'm helping new shooters out and they're asking about form, because I have terrible form and I'm a trigger puncher, but my terrible form is repeatable. I tell people all the time, say your bow is a machine. It will do the exact same thing every single time. you need to be a machine. You need to do the exact same thing every single time. You need to count your steps. Okay, I feel my string touching here. I feel my, you know, my 3-4 contact points. My ankle point is here. My grip is a certain way. And the follow through, I'm holding the pin on that target, watching it. Don't even drop my arm down until I hit the, you know, hear the arrow hit. You know, all these things like that. And I'm always constantly telling people that. I'm like, if you look at me, I can't tell you how many people have criticized how I draw down here across my chest before I bring it up. You know, everyone's like, oh, why do you do that? You know, I'm like, dude, because I've been doing that for 30-something years, and it's repeatable. And I'm not going to change my form because it works for me. You know, and right. It's funny that you say that. I'm actually happy that you did, because it's one that irks me all the time, because there's guys that I know, they're just so like, oh, you know, you gotta squeeze your shoulder blades together or this. Oh yeah, because I grip the bow like this, you know, I hold it. I mean, I keep my hand open when I'm drawing back, and then I close my fingers around it. But everybody's like, oh, you got, you know, your pinky's got to be out like this, and you got to be like, stop, you know, da, ba, 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 ba. And I'm like, dude, I mean, yeah, if you're teaching somebody from who's never picked up a bow before in their life, and, you know, you want to try to get them on the right track, that's great. But if, you know, or if a guy's having a really hard time with, you know, torquing the bow, and he doesn't torque it the same way, but I might torque my bow when I shoot the way I shoot, but I torque it the same way every time. So I know the arrow's going to hit where, you know? So, but I mean, I get, like you said, it's all well-intentioned stuff, but you got to think about it from the standpoint that, if you think about it like that, the bow's a machine, you need to be a machine, meaning you need to be able to repeat exactly what you do every single time in every single situation. And you're going to be successful, you know. Yeah. At least arrows are going to go where you're shooting them at. I don't know if you're going to be successful on that, but
right.
So
yeah, and I see, you know, from January through the end of August, I see archers constantly coming up wanting to know how to handle this situation, how to handle that. You know, all these different things that, you know, relate back to form. And you can't put everyone in the same box. It's just impossible. So I have I coach on the side, and I had a guy, this has been 10 years ago, come to me, and he was a really tall guy, about 6'5", played a lot of softball in his day, and he'd messed himself up a little bit structurally from playing softball and things like that. And he just couldn't. He couldn't get his right arm. He was right-handed shooter, and couldn't get his right elbow up. It was super, super low, and he had so many things going wrong against him. You know, if you want to put him in that realm. But what he had working for him was he was a competitor, and he had the right mindset, and so. When we started working with his form, and he couldn't get him to, you know, be able to change so many things as far as, you know, the way his bone structure was made, I said, well, you know what? None of this matters. I said, let's just do it. What feels good to you? And he's like, that right there feels good. I said, boom, that's it. Let's not fight this any longer. Let's say, this is it. Let's take pictures. So, you know, that this is right. And then, all we need to do is we just need to work on your mental ability to aim and execute. And when we get those things right, you'll be doing just fine. And that guy's a great shooter. He really is. He doesn't, you know, compete, you know, nationally or anything like that. But on a local level, I mean, he's one of the better ones around. He's got everything really. I mean, that it would take to make it on a national level. He just, you know, it's just not his goal, but guy hardly ever has a bad round. And, you know, when you'd look at him, he wouldn't put him as one of the better shooters around, but it's pretty bad as far as that form. But he's, you know, you got the right mental attitude, you can do it. So just repeat.
Let's talk a little bit about tuning. Like, what are things that a hunter should be checking on the regular to make sure the bow is shooting the same as it was when he sighted it in, when he set it up, or when he had it set up?
Well, what I try and do with it, with every bow that I set up, I try and make certain measurements and all that sort of stuff. You know, you write all this stuff down, what everything should be, right? I mean, the basic thing is, okay, so what is my axle to axle length, and what is this, what is that? But honestly, the best thing that I find is just to take a pencil and mark across the limb onto the cam where you have a perfect line. And once you mark that across the limb, both top and bottom cam, and you create that exact line, you know, to be able to look at and take your eyeball, get your limb where it's horizontal with your, you know, eyesight where you can see all the way across and have a nice check mark on there. And as long as that line always stays in the exact same spot, then everything should be staying the same as far as, you know, your string and cable stretch, that sort of thing. And then the next thing would obviously be I measure my peep side height from my loop height. I measure that from the axle, from the top axle. And of course, you could measure it from anywhere as long as it's a constant, but that's just the way I always do it. And if you've got those three things in line, everything should stay pretty much in line as far as, you know, day in, day out. It should remain the same. Now, the thing about it is, though, the reality is, if you shoot much, it can't stay the same. It's just not going to. And by moving, it's pretty funny. I was talking to my brother yesterday, and he is a hunting fool. I mean, the guy loves to hunt. He just does not like to get out and shoot his bow. So literally a week before season starts, every year he pulls his bow out. He walks out, and you talk about the guy that can shoot cold. That's him, because he's never warm. He doesn't shoot enough to ever get warm. But he walks out, he fires, usually goes to 30 yards, fires one arrow. It hits because it's the same as it was last year, right? I mean, he ain't done anything different. He's just left it in the bow case, puts it in the gun safe in the house, stays nice and cool. I mean, so it's not like he's getting any issues with his bow. Goes out, shoots a few times, hits the dots, come back in. That's exactly what he told me yesterday. He said, man, I can't believe it. He said, that bow's been the same for 4 years. I ain't touched a thing on it. And he's killed a ton of, I mean, pretty much everything he shoots at, he kills, you know. I mean, part of it's because he knows how to get right on top of them. And you know, when you're bow hunting, that's key, is getting close. But, yeah, he's that guy that doesn't practice, doesn't shoot, doesn't hardly do anything. But it stays the same for him. The same for him and the same for me are two different things. You know, he's looking at, can I hit a pie plate at 40 yards? And I'm looking at, you know, can I hit a 1-inch dot at 40 yards? And so after you knock an arrow on the string a certain amount of times, that serving goes from being round to flat, right? That changes the way the arrow comes off of the string. And there's really no way to fix it other than pulling the serving off and reserving it and starting all over again. So that's a pain in the rump to have to deal with. But, you know, you can get one to last. I think I've had a target bow last basically all year long without having to make hardly any changes. And that's saying something, because that don't happen very often. But I had a Victory X, not this past year, but season before last, that I basically didn't touch all year long. And that was, and I just used it for the ASA circuit. I didn't use it at IBO or any of the other ones. So it was only getting action, you know, at those events. And, you know, every once in a while in practice, I would hang it up when I get home. And I had a bow that I practiced with a lot just so I could wear that one out instead of wearing my good shooting bow out. So, but yeah, and that's another thing too. when you get one tuned up and dialed in really good, in the past, that has been a major issue. And with some of the new product that's out, especially the 2020 Elite model bows, and that is so easy. Getting these bows in tune now, it's just crazy easy. So,
yeah, let's you know what? Let's talk about a little bit about those 2020 bows right now, since you kind of led into it. I was going to ask you about them. You know, everybody knows that I've been a Matthews guy, but I never when I'm working, you know, volunteering my time at the archery shop, I never say, oh, you got to be in a Matthews, you know, whatever feels best for the person and whatever suits their needs. That's what I feel like they should be in. There's a bow out there for everyone. So I don't ever like to tell people. I mean, I shoot what I shoot because I have my reasons. You know, there's something about Matthews that's comfortable to me, and I've grown to not grown to it, you know. Well, now I've grown to only love that way that feeling is, and other bows feel foreign to me. But you know, when I first started shooting it, that's what felt comfortable. That's what had the best performance at the time, and so on and so forth. But through the years, you know, year after year, bows change. Things aren't, you know, and there's a lot of new technology out there. So what's let's hear a little bit about the new bows.
Yeah, well, to touch on your on the way you like, I mean, I've driven a Ford ever since I was in high school. You know, that's just the way it is. I like those Fords, you know. Don't hold that against me if you like something else, but you know, we get stuck in those in that brand loyalty thing, which is I won't say it's unique to archery, because obviously you see that across everything. If you play guitars, some guys only like Taylors, some guys like Martins, you know, whatever. But these new 2020 Elites, and I gotta say, Matt McPherson makes one heck of a guitar, by the way. Jeez, like playing a. Well, I've never driven a Ferrari, but I can imagine myself driving a Ferrari, and I have actually played one of those guitars, and they are amazing. But you're right, new technology, and so that's one of those things. Up until that point, I've played all kinds of other guitars. I like Taylors, I like Martins, and I'm not this great guitar player or anything by any means, but the first time I ever played one of those, I thought, holy smokes, this is insane how this guitar sounds and feels. It's new technology. I mean, that's what he brought to the table, was a different way of doing it, and it was really impressive. Switch over to archery. 2020 Elite bows have new technology in them that's never been seen in the archery industry before. And it has made the ability to tune broadheads. And this started with a target bow that I was playing with. And that's where the idea kind of came from. And then we went from there and then took it to an engineer there at Elite. And he designed everything up and we got it all working as a prototype all last summer, basically. I've been playing with a target bow that has this technology on it to see if it would do everything that I needed to do, and it would do more than what I was expecting it to do. And when they started playing with it themselves, they basically scrapped their whole idea for 2020, what they were going to do for a hunting bow. Because when they saw what this technology was doing, they said, man, we have got to put this into a hunting model. And I'm sitting there screaming the same thing. Yes, because I want this in my hunting bow. I don't want to have to target shoot. Or I don't want to have to hunt with my target bow because I like it so much. But so absolutely brought new technology to the market. And what this does, it's called SET technology. And it stands for Simplified Exact Tuning. And it is micro adjustments that you make at the rear of the limb pocket that affects your cam attitude, that totally changes the way your arrow flies. So if you're familiar with yoke tuning, if you're familiar with the top hats that Matthews uses, they have for swapping cams spacing around. Well, this is very similar to that style of tuning, but it's done so simple that you don't have to use a bow press for any of it. You can make the adjustments right on the shooting line. When you're outside tuning your broadheads, you don't have to go back and forth in the shop with the press to swap spacers or swap top hats or put twist in a yoke. Or there's no bow press needed whatsoever at all. All you have to do is make a slight turn, top and bottom. Or you could just, when you're getting into the micro tuning adjustments, it's just a tiny little adjustment, top or bottom. And I'm just give you an example here to tell you how I adjusted this set technology to be able to tune my broadheads. Fixed blades, by the way, not mechanicals. I'm shooting fixed blade. And so I'm a big tuner. I love working with, you know, just finding out what makes everything tick. And so with the very first time that I got one of these bows and started working with it, I like to bear shaft tune. I like to tune every arrow by bear shaft tuning. And what that does is that gives me the confidence and the reassurance that every arrow is dynamically reacting the exact same way out of the bow. Or if you want to magnify that, you put a fixed blade broadhead on the front of the arrow and watch that change, because it is, to me, it's really amazing just how much it changes and how fast it changes. So I bear shaft every arrow and shoot it where my field points and my bear shafts, my fletched arrows and my bear shaft, hit the exact same spot at 20 yards. Get every arrow that will do that exact same thing. Put a broadhead on, I fletch all those arrows, and I go out and, of course, I index those arrows wherever they're at, and then I go out and shoot them at 30 yards with a broadhead, and I turn my nock just for the heck of it, just to see. I've got it indexed where it bear shafted. Then I turn my nock, I shoot a four fletch, so I turn it every quarter all the way around to see if that arrow changes its impact point. And what I find is most of them do, and it's really detrimental to the accuracy when you get a dozen arrows. You can't just throw them together and go out there and shoot them and expect every arrow to shoot the same. This is one area where I will say the money you spend, the amount of money you spend, you actually get what you pay for, because I have not found a cheap low-end arrow that is accurate with the rest of the dozen. You wind up with maybe two arrows that hit and four arrows that are all over the place. I mean, they might as well be totally scrapped. And, you know, I mean, it's two group over here, two group over there. And it's one of those things where people say, man, I just can't get my fixed blade broadheads just don't shoot worth a darn, you know. Well, typically, what I found, it's not as much the broadhead as you would think. It's the arrow. So when you work the arrow over and you get the best out of each arrow and what they will actually do for you shooting-wise, then you can go back to the broadhead and say, okay, now I'm going to try this and see if this works. And so it starts with, you know, going to the arrow spinner. You test the broadheads. You make sure the broadheads spin straight. If you want to test an arrow and see, you know, if you spin the nock every quarter and it changes, you know, a 6-inch circle around the dot, basically, as you spun the nock and you want to test it, put a different broadhead on, see if it does the same thing. You know, it might be the broadhead on that particular arrow. Maybe it's not the actual arrow. So again, the broadhead just magnifies everything. All right. So I said all that lead into this new technology that's on this bow. So once I figured out all that kind of stuff, which don't get me wrong, I spend hours and hours messing with arrows and broadheads to get them all right. And when I finally got them all right, this is actually when I was shooting the Ritual last year. I'm using the same hunting arrows, you know, from last year to this year. So when I finally got them all right, I take those arrows with this new bow, this new 2020 Cure that we have, and with the set technology at 40 yards, it took me 4 arrows to get my fixed blades hitting exactly the same spot as my field point. I mean, they were hitting pretty close at 20 yards. At 30 yards, they were, you know, an inch or so off. And then at 40, I could tell there was about 4 inches. And so I just made tiny little adjustments until it just, boom, right in there. So I was shooting all the way back to 80 yards with the fixed blades, and they were shooting right with my field points. And I say right with my field points. Technically, I guess at about 60 yards, I start hitting on the bottom side of the dot. It starts shooting a little bit lower, but I expect that. It's more wind drag. You know, you can't expect a field point to shoot the same speed through a chronograph at 60 yards as a broadhead tipped arrow. You know, field tipped arrow versus broadhead is just going to slow down because it's got more wind drag. So it is shooting just a little bit lower, but as far as the line, everything's perfect. It's the easiest tuning system I have ever messed with, and I'm not just blowing smoke. You have to try it to understand how easy it is. If on the riser itself, it has a little call out. So if you're getting a left tear through paper or a right tear through paper, it tells you which direction to turn it. So it's that simple that the user will be able, you know, if he just buys a bow from a dealer and takes it home and, you know, he takes his bow box with him, cuts a hole in a bow box, sticks a piece of paper up on it, he can paper tune really quick right there. You know, you don't need an elaborate setup or whatever. You can just do it. I mean, if you got all that, that's great. But the point being is that it's super, super user friendly. And that's what we were going for, was something that you don't need a bow press to adjust. The draw length and the draw weight, the let off, you don't need a bow press for any of it. Absolutely none of it. If you want to change the draw length, a quarter of an inch, our modules rotate. We have a rotating mod on this ACM Tri-Track cam that rotates. And you can, if you want 70% let off, you can move it to 70%. Well, when you move it to 70 from 90%, it changes your draw length. But the cool thing is all you have to do is you want to adjust it a quarter inch or a half inch different. Now, you don't need a bow press to do it. You just take a couple of screws out, rotate the mod where you need it, put it right back in, and you're ready to go. Actually, I say put it right back in. You don't even have to take the screws out. They just, you loosen them and it slides and it locks right back in place. So
sounds pretty badass, man.
It is. It's
I'll do a lot with that top hat tuning on my Matthews, and you know, it makes a world of difference. I, you know, my bow shoots laser beams with broadheads and field tips, but that would be awesome. Then I'd have to put it in I have to go to the bow shop because I don't have a bow press at my house, and nor do I have the know-how, honestly, to do it on my own. So,
well, that's the cool thing about that too, is that, like I said, with the little call outs on the riser, I mean, if you know how to read a paper tear, that's all you have to be able to do. And there's manuals all over the internet for learning how to read a paper tear. And if you can read a paper tear, you can tune the bow, and it is so easy to do. And, you know, I mean, I don't want this to be you know, just going on and on and on about the new bow, because the reality is, I mean, it's still a riser. Yep. It's still a set of limbs. You still have to draw it back, and you have to do everything yourself, you know, perfectly to shoot the bow accurately. Right. But the new technology is fantastic. I think you will I think you'll be impressed. I know personally myself, there's very few things that I see in archery these days that's really new. You just don't see it. You see a redesigned idea from time to time, and you get numb to it after a while. I've been in this industry for a long, long time, and new year rolls around, new products hit the market, and you, all right, well, here we are again. What is that? Oh, yeah, we did that back in the 80s. Yeah. And we did this in the 90s, and they did that then, you know, and hey, that's a pretty cool spin on it, you know. So sometimes you just don't see new technology, and that's what this is new technology. So it's pretty neat.
Well, I'm going to I'm going to stop you right there and take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll hit the rest of these questions.
Okay, sounds good.
Hey guys, if you're looking for a really good hunt, every year, my outfitting service, Days in the Wild, we take out a handful of clients for deer and javelina in the archery season and rifle seasons here. It's too late to get a rifle tag now for deer, but the draw is opening for javelina, and if you want to get a rifle tag for javelina, or you'd like to come out and do a combination archery javelina hunt, archery deer and javelina hunt, give me a shout. Hit me up on Instagram or Facebook, or hit me up on the blog, or go to our website, daysinthewild.com, and contact us through there. We can talk about it and build you your hunt of your, I don't know, I want to say of your dreams, but definitely an awesome time and lots of action and really true Western experience where you're getting to do a lot of spot and stalk, getting to navigate the mountains. It's a good time. Great weather that time of year. Most of our hunts take place in December and January for the deer and javelina combination. And if you're coming just for javelina, those are typically in February. So give us a shout, and we'll put together a great hunt for you. Thanks.